All right, thank you very much. So I'm going to tell you something about Parity violating electron scattering, and in particular a little bit about what we're doing at Jefferson Lab and what we're planning on doing in the future at Jefferson Lab. And this is a fancy representation of electron scattering with photon and Z exchange and some indication that it's parity violating. So the outline is a little review of the basic science behind it, tell you a little bit about the Q-Week experiment, tell you the first results, which we published a few years ago. Apologies, we don't have our final result yet. I had hoped that we'd be ready, but soon. I'll give you the prospects for the final result, tell you a little bit about the sensitivity to new physics, and then, if time permits, a little bit of review of standard model test with parity violating electron scattering in the future at Jefferson Lab. So a very brief history. Of course, you're familiar with the parity violation, weak interactions needed to explain nuclear beta decay, the discovery of parity violation in cobalt-60 decay, and almost simultaneously in pi and muon decay. Of course, this is charge current. The neutral current process was originally a handful of events in the Gargamel bubble chamber. But it really wasn't until parity violation was observed in electron scattering at SLAC that this neutral current was shown to be really the Weinberg-Salam-Glashow neutral current. So parity violating electron scattering, one has longitudinally polarized electrons coming in. If you do a parity inversion, you realize that it's equivalent to a helicity flip of the electron. So the observable is to compare right-handed electron scattering cross-section to left-handed electron scattering cross-section. This was originally proposed by Zeldovich back in the 50s as an observable. So we form an asymmetry. Asymmetry is just right minus left over the sum. And this really manifests itself because of electroweak interference. So you're getting an interference between the virtual photon and Z exchange. And so the difference picks out the interference term between the parity conservating and parity violating neutral currents. And the total cross-section is dominated by the purely electromagnetic process. So the scale of these asymmetries is roughly the amplitude for the Z neutral current over the amplitude of the photon exchange. And so to set that into scale, this then is scales as a photon coupling here. You see the propagator, the weak interaction here. And so at the kind of scales that we're dealing with, a few GeV or less Q squared, asymmetries are hundreds, tens of parts per million, or down to tens of parts per billion. And of course, the asymmetry can come in both through the axial piece of the electron current and the vector piece of whatever your target is, or it can come in the vector piece of the electron current and the axial piece of the target. So historically, this was first done by Charlie Prescott et al. At SLAC, pioneering measurement. And in fact, the experimental technique, we've just been building on that and refining basic ideas. You have some detector, a spectrometer to select out elastically scattered, or in this case, deep inelastic scattering. So this was from a deuterium isoscalar target. You have a high-intensity electron gun where you reverse the helicity using a polarized laser on a source, and you detect and integrate the rate of scattered electrons because you need very high statistics. And I like to tell my students this really is textbook physics because it's one of the examples that Perkins' book points out very clearly, and these figures are actually from Perkins' book. And so one of the ways, of course, you can reverse the helicity is actually use the G minus 2 precession of the electron as it goes through the accelerator and change the beam energy a little bit. And so that's one of the ways that they did a reversal in the Prescott experiment. So this was really pivotal in establishing the SE2 cross U1 gauge theory as the weak interaction component of the standard model. It was also a critical test of the parton model. So these experimental techniques of optically pumped electron sources, rapid helicity reversal, integrating the scattered flux, and exquisite monitoring of the beam to deal with helicity-correlated fluctuations in the beam are things that we follow up with. But this is just through one kinematic variable. This is the electron, the shared energy to the transferred energy to the electron. asymmetry along here, different data points at different beam energies. And this is a projection of the Weinberg's law model. This was a competitive model at the time, and you see that it really was a validation of electroweak theory. There were two later experiments, one at Mainz and one at Bates, that followed up, again, as measurements of sine squared theta w, or what we might now think of as tests of the standard model, using generally this technique. So again, E122 at SLAC, I made these same statements again. The scale of the asymmetry they measured, nowadays we would think as falling off a log easy, 100 part per million with 10% error bars, first measurement of sine squared theta w. A second experiment at SLAC in the 1990s did electron-electron scattering to get at, again, sine squared theta w, and this was actually the first electron-electron weak force measurement. The asymmetry here was hundreds of parts per billion, making a nice measurement at the time of the electroweak mixing angle. So if I look at the parity-violating piece in the standard model in the electroweak Lagrangian, I can write it down again in terms of axial electron current, vector, say quark current, electron, vector, and axial quark, these things. So we can rewrite conventionally this piece here or this piece here in terms of what we call the C1 coefficient. So you can be thinking of this as a measurement of the vector weak charge of the quarks, the C1s. You could also look at an axial charge of the quarks here as the C2s. Experimentally, at small scattering angles in the lab, you're sensitive to the vector part of the quark interaction. And for the larger scattering angles, you bring in the axial piece. So if I look at electric charges and then think of these other terms and call them weak vector charges because they're the weak neutral current analog of the electric charge, there's some amusing sort of symmetries here that with the Weinberg angle values, the electric charge of the up quark sort of starts looking like a vector charge that looks kind of like opposite of the electric charge of the down quark. And amusingly, the proton weak charge is accidentally small because sine squared theta w is near a quarter. So that's nice if we're looking for physics beyond the standard model because you've suppressed the standard model signal just by the coincidence of sine squared theta w. And also amusingly, the neutron weak charge is large. So it's kind of the inverse of the electric charge. And as I think people have mentioned, this can be used as a way of measuring neutron distributions in nuclei. But if I focus now on the proton's weak charge, the idea is that if I focus at low Q squared, where we're dominated by the C1 coefficients, or equivalently by the vector charges, a measurement of the parity-violating asymmetry accesses the weak charge of the proton. And so schematically then, again, with some essentially kinematic and couplings out in front, you get the weak charge of the proton from the asymmetry. Now, what we're looking at, of course, is physics beyond the standard model. To think about how that might manifest itself, you can think about collapsing the interaction into a four fermion contact interaction to talk about an effective parity-violating electron quark couplings. And so now your cross-section has the photon and the Z and whatever new physics is involved. And so you'll see interference not only of the electromagnetic with the Z, but electromagnetic with the new physics. And sort of dimensional arguments, planned measurement that of something like a 4% precision of the weak charge. If you look at a mass over coupling scale, then you find scales of order TeV for measuring this precision of the weak charge, which is the goal of our experiment. What kind of new physics could come into play? Well, you can have in loops, you could have R parity conserving SUSY. You could have R parity violating SUSY in T-channel exchange. You can have Z primes. You could have leptoquarks. And of course, other models could conceivably be sensitive as long as they have axial and vector couplings. We're also sensitive to, and you saw this, I think, on Tuesday from Kurt Allenbacher's talk, potentially to the dark sector. We've heard about the dark photon idea. Bill Marciano had an interesting idea of expanding the dark sector and saying, well, maybe we can't see the dark photon because it doesn't decay to E plus E minus because there's other lighter particles in the dark sector which dominate its decay. So that avoids any bump hunting things. If you do have such a thing, maybe the also, if you have an expanded Higgs sector in the dark sector, like a two Higgs doublet model, then you can have mixing between that dark photon, which he now calls a dark Z, with the ordinary Z, and that would show up as well. And so that evades a lot of the dark photon limits. You can talk about how it may evade many of them. It might still allow this dark sector to explain the G minus 2 anomaly in his model, and we would have some sensitivity there. This is a measurement of the running of sine squared theta W. And again, Kurt showed this on Tuesday, I think. So this is normalized by the measurements at the Z pole that sets a scale of that unknown running. This is then a standard model running here. These are the measurements. This is the E158 measurement and our first measurement from QWeek, which I'll talk about. Victor is the expert on the atomic parity violation. His calculation is involved with this measurement of Carl Wieman's cesium atomic parity violation experiment. These are the different bands that would come out from different masses of a dark Z. There's a sign ambiguity in the calculation, so we might have some sensitivity. These, again, are proposed sensitivities from our final result from QWeek. This is the P2 experiment that Kurt measured, and this is electron-electron parity violating experiment at JLab. One thing I want to point out about this figure is, in the context of the standard model, all the experiments should lie on the curve. In the context of physics beyond the standard model, different observables can lie on the off the curve in different manner. If the new physics, for example, is quark-phobic, you'll see it in the molar experiment, but you will not see it in QWeek and vice versa. We have some sensitivity in these kinds of experiments, for example, to SUSY. So this is the minimal supersymmetric standard model, our parity conserving. This is the deviation from the weak charge of the proton from standard model. This is the deviation of the weak charge from the electron. This is our proposed sensitivity around 4%. This would be something like the P2 experiment or better, 2.5%. This is the molar experiment at JLab, which I'll mention. And of course, you can also relax our parity violating. It doesn't allow SUSY to be dark matter, but you can start digging into the phase space there with these sorts of measurements. But there is some hadronic physics, because of course the target is a proton. We're looking at coherent scattering from the quarks and the proton, but we do have to worry about structure at some level. So the asymmetry a little bit beyond the leading term, there's an higher order hadronic structure that comes in powers of Q squared here. And so if I now try to divide out the leading Q squared dependence and I plot a reduced asymmetry, which is just this thing dividing out this leading term, then, in fact, the weak charge of the proton will be extrapolating some Q-squared dependence, which is given by this hadronic physics, down to zero. So fortunately, there have been a host of experiments at Jefferson Lab and elsewhere to make those measurements. They were not motivated by physics beyond the standard model. They were motivated by hadron structure. They were motivated in actually, interesting story, by looking for strange contributions to the charge structure and charge and magnetic structure of the nucleon. And so these experiments have contributions from electromagnetic form factors and potentially from strange form factors. So we make this measurement at this very low Q squared, and we use this host of other precise experiments to help us pin down the extrapolation to Q squared equals zero. We can't measure at Q squared equals zero because our asymmetry goes like Q squared. So you need some momentum transfer in there. Let's see, what else? So one thing I wanted to say, in fact, this is one of the few fields where lattice is now well ahead of experiment. The most recent lattice calculation, the strange form factors, have beat the hell out of the experiment here. And so, in fact, we could analyze our data with ignoring this dependence, except for the pure electromagnetic form factor part, and use the lattice for strange contributions. It turns out that the precision we get from this fit and the precision we get from using the lattice are identical, so it makes no difference. So I just tried to argue that the hadronic structure is well under control, but The running is actually electroweak radiative corrections. We're looking for the physics in loops or other exchanges. Do we understand the loop, the running, in the standard model? Well, in fact, there are these electroweak radiative corrections can be parameterized as a running or a change of the weak charge with different terms that come in from self-energies of the W and Z, vertex corrections, and box diagrams. And we define the weak charge as the value at Q squared equals zero and energy equals zero. We proposed the experiment, got it funded, and started building it, and we believed all of those corrections were under theoretical control. And Misha Gorstein and Chuck Horowitz gave me many nights of poor sleep when they pointed out that one of these diagrams, the gamma Z box, was not under as good control because of hadronic effects than had been anticipated. And the reason is simply that, you know, when these are both W's or both Z's, this you can do from PQCD. It's straightforward. But the gamma Z, because of the photon leg, it's not PQCD friendly, right? There's actual hadronic physics that you have to worry about here, virtual excitations, deep inelastic processes, and the integrals are not trivial. So they gave us a lot of grief. It turns out that different groups have done these calculations, informed by data in many cases, and the groups are coming to excellent agreement on the size of this. To put this into scale, the weak charge is about 6.7%. in the standard model, so these are about 8%, 9% corrections, substantial, but the theoretical uncertainty, and they actually have worked hard on really what a theoretical error bar is, mainly because they're driven by dispersion theory. So what they've done is taken real data, put it into dispersion theory analysis. They can use the uncertainties and the data to drive the uncertainties on this correction. And so we've made some measurements as well in our experiment to help inform those calculations, but we believe now the error bars are under control at the level that we're interested in. So how do we do the experiment? There are lots of challenges. I'm an experimentalist, and I'll tell you almost nothing about how we do those things, but we use a JLab record current, 180 microamps, the luminosity is 10 to the 39 on the target, high power cryogenic target. The beam actually deposits 2.5 kilowatts into our liquid hydrogen target, and we were able to make it not boil. So there's some technical challenges there. Very rapid helicity reversal, low Q squared, so small scattering angle, very large detected rate, 6 gigahertz we're integrating over. Radiation hard detectors, low noise ADCs. We don't have the luxury of the EDM experiments where there's so many different kinds of reversals. The only thing that we can reverse is the helicity because it's an unpolarized target. We don't have electric fields and magnetic fields to reverse. But we can reverse the helicity in a number of different ways. So we have a rapid reversal that we do 960 hertz. We do a slow reversal where we change the relationship between the sign of the polarization of the laser beam compared to what's actually coming out in the electron beam. We reverse as well an electron beam in the accelerator, and then we do a G-2 by changing the beam energy. And we have to measure beam polarization, beam current, et cetera. So there's the overall picture of the apparatus. It's a toroidal magnetic spectrometer target through some collimators onto these radiation hard fused silica quartz detectors, some collimators to define acceptance, and we do kinematic measurements with some tracking chambers that we put in periodically to the measurement. And that's just the magnet and the device. There's one of the main detectors here. These are some of the drift chambers I built. This is the experiment as it was being built. First result, we were on the floor for a little more than 2 years in Hall C at Jefferson Lab. We ran in several different periods. The very first couple of weeks of beam, we used a different blinding factor than the main experiment so that we knew we wanted to unblind an early result. We did that. It's about 1/25th of our total data set. We published it. The asymmetry is 280 parts per billion with those uncertainties and those kinematics. And as I'll show you, that was in excellent agreement with the standard model prediction. So back to this hadronic form factor kind of extrapolation. There's our preliminary, that our first run data set here. Extrapolating down, this fit now includes our precision and all of the other experiments, and the little arrow is the standard model value. So the weak charge that we extracted was 6.4% plus or minus 1.2, and that's the standard model value. We can also interpret that in terms of the vector charges of the quarks. So if I look at C1u minus C1d, which is really what we're sensitive to, these blue ellipses are our measurement, also using the other HAPEX and G0 experiments along the way to get that fit. So this is 68% and 95% confidence level in this. Now we can combine that with the atomic parity violation, the cesium measurement of Wyman. And it has the beautiful thing that it's almost orthogonal in its sensitivity because it's mainly the neutron weak charge that it measures. They can't extract directly the weak charge of the neutron from that measurement without knowing the weak charge of the proton. So this is the atomic parity violating measurement. Then the overlap between these things is here. This is sine squared theta w in the context of the standard model, and that's the measurement. So we're in good agreement with the standard model, and we can then extract the neutron weak charge from an experiment that didn't use a neutron at all. And again, it's in, as you could guess from this figure, it's in excellent agreement with the standard model. All right, so we've got 25 times as much data in the CAM. I was interested in John Doyle's talk where he explained that, you know, you go to a higher level of precision, you find a systematic error you don't understand, and then there's 6 months. Well, in our case, that's more like a year and a half. We hit one major systematic, which if there are interest afterwards, I can explain. But let me show you, and we're working through refining the understanding of that last systematic. The experiment worked very nicely. This shows the blinded asymmetry versus a data set number from what we call run two, which is about two-thirds of our statistics. And so this asymmetry is blinded, so you can't read the weak charge off of it. The black points are the raw data, so they average to minus 161.8. After correcting for helicity-correlated beam motion, which is the bugaboo of all these experiments, experiment was very, we could correct, make very small corrections, it agreed nicely. We had one unexpected background that we corrected for, again, very nicely. So the agreement is beautiful, the probability of these all being the same number is quite adequate. We can do a non-parity violating combination, so this is a combination that should not have a physics asymmetry in it. It's nicely consistent with zero and nicely stable, and the probability of this being stable increases to being nice once you make those last corrections. There was a quick, there was another measurement in Hall A where we went after the C2 coefficients, the axial piece of the hadronic current, basically repeating the Prescott experiment to higher precision, so it's sensitive to the C2s. Large asymmetries, other experimental challenges. So this is, again, the C1s, the vector coefficients. So this band here would be all experiments before this most recent one. This is a Prescott experiment, which is an ellipse which goes through the roof. The Hall A parity-violating deep inelastic measurement is this ellipse. And so then we were able to see this combination of the axial C2s as consistent, again, with the standard model prediction. To put that into a sense of physics reach, if I take electron and quark compositeness or some contact interaction limits, and I'm using a particular convention on choosing what the couplings should be, so this is a mass limit in either positive or negative deviations, where the positive or negative deviations are whether or not we're above or below the standard model value for these couplings. And so the sensitivities here, this is again the vector piece, this is the axial piece. This is before the Hall A experiment, but including Q weak. So you see we're digging into sensitivities at the 10 TeV level in this convention. When you put in the Hall A axial piece, then you can sort of eliminate all these combinations out to about 5 or 6 TeV. You compare that most directly to what was done at Hera, Zeus and H1 limits, which were on the scale of 3 or 4 TeV on particular terms. Atlas published limits from the 7 TeV run that look higher, and they are higher, but they're in a particular model. And what they have to do in those models, they have to assume all the other couplings are zero, that there are no other parity-violating pieces. We don't have to make any assumptions about those other contact interactions. So that's some advantages to these things. So in the last 3 or 4 minutes, we will be updating it, the E158 slack measurement to 5 or 6 times higher precision at Jefferson Lab. There's also an improved experiment that will run for solid to measure the weak couplings, the C2s to higher precision, and then, as Kurt mentioned a couple of days ago, the P2 experiment, which will improve on Q-weak by a factor of, they hope, 2 or 3. So the molar experiment is now looking at electron-electron scattering, get the weak charge for the electron, small expected asymmetry, high luminosity. We now have to talk about parts per trillion uncertainties, which is another language for us at this scale. For this combination of couplings, it would have contact interaction sensitivities very, very high. In fact, an order of magnitude higher than the LEP2 limits on those sorts of things. If I think about it in terms of compositeness in that same convention, this is up to sort of 40 TeV. It would be sensitive to doubly charged scalars, heavy Z primes, SUSY, dark Zs, etc. I'm going to skip over that, just show you a picture. The experiment is not like what I am. It's long and skinny. I wish I was long and skinny, but I'm not. And so the experiment's about 28 meters long, very forward angle scattering, set of detectors here, novel toroidal magnetic field. And then the solid experiment, which we will also hope to do in Hall A in the future at 12 GeV, is looking again for the C2s. It's going back to deep inelastic scattering. And the problem with interpreting the asymmetries in terms of the C2s, well, you can also get access to the C1s. These are kinematic factors that you can vary. There are some interpretation issues there because you have to worry about charge symmetry violation, which will affect the asymmetry. You also have to worry about higher twist and understanding the hadronic structure. The plan is to make a measurement in this large acceptance device over such a broad range of kinematics that will tease out the hadronic physics of charge symmetry, the hadronic physics of higher twist, and the beyond the standard model of through those coupling constants. Second to last slide, I think. So then, again, in a phase space of the C1s, let's see, the red ellipses are the particle data group fits. This is Q-weak. This would be what solid would be able to do to the C1s, a different linear coefficient combination. Over here are the axial charges. Again, this is the present Hall A 6 GeV number, essentially, and this is the precision that solid will reach. And a table of comparisons of different sensitivities of the precisions of the atomic parity, existing E158, Q-weak, initial result, final result, and these later experiments. This is a table courtesy of Jens Erler. So the summary. We made a first measurement of the proton's weak charge. And frustratingly, it's completely consistent with the standard model. We have 25 times more data. I forgot to mention that we expect the experiment to be statistics limited. We believe all of the systematics we've been able to beat down. Talked a little bit about Q-weak and PVDIS and the constraints on new physics from combining these two, and then mentioned the program for the future at Jefferson Lab with 2 complementary standard model tests, again looking at the quarks and looking at electron-electron. Thanks to the organizers for the kind invitation, and thanks to all of you for staying here rather than going to the beach. And then I should just mention my dear collaborators at Q-Week. Thank you.
The molar and solid, they're both in Hall A, you mentioned.
Yep.
They cannot be in at the same time, can they?
Absolutely not. The plan is we have enough space that we could move molar in and out and put in solid, that they're attempting to leave space on either side. The practicalities of that, I'm a little skeptical, but the intent is that with the molar experiment, we want to run in 3 stages, an engineering run that would be maybe 6 months, a first data-taking run that would get to about a factor of 2 precision over the E158 measurement, and then a final run with the idea of having maybe a year, a year and a half in between to think and to tweak if necessary. So that would be consistent with the idea of bringing in some other project. But neither are yet funded.
So quick. explanation of your systematic?
The systematic. Okay, well, let's see, where is it? Yeah. So we have polarized electron, longitudinally polarized electrons. Of course, they precess when they go through the toroid. So some of them become transverse when they hit the main detector. We actually put a layer of pre-radiator, of lead, in front of the main detector for technical reasons. There's an analyzing power when you have an electron hitting the lead, and especially when you have a shower, because you get low energy, you actually get the Mott asymmetry, very low energy components of the shower have humongous, you know, 10% asymmetries. And what that does is cause an asymmetry that becomes left and right on our main detector. We read out one phototube here and one phototube here. So you get an opposite effect here that you get here. They should cancel if the apparatus is symmetric. But we didn't anticipate this. So we found that the different, that each one of the asymmetries of these positive photomultiplier tubes was very different than the negative ones. The scale of this effect is as the same size as our parity violating signal. It's a few hundred part per billion. So what we're having to understand is how well do we understand, oh, I should just show you. So it couples to the optical response of the main detector and imperfections in the optical response of the main detector, how well they're canceling. So we believe it cancels to two orders of magnitude. We're trying to verify that with Monte Carlo simulations and benchmarking the detectors. So that was the one. Completely unexpected.
I just wanted to remind that the first attempt to measure the parity violating asymmetry in DIS was done at Serpukhov in 76.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, they extracted muons from pion decay, and you can have them longitudinally polarized, so yep. You can flip the longitudinal polarization. But they are shorter in statistics by a factor of 10 than necessary.
Okay. I will have to look up that reference. Thank you.
Just again, a little comment, because you mentioned that you use parity violation, which is orthogonal to your experiment. Very nice. So you extracted both weak charges. Mm-hmm. But see, the progress with parity violation is now is limited by theoretical accuracy. And there is another method to do it. It's measure parity ratio of parity violating effects in different isotopes.
Oh, of course, yes.
And atomic uncertainty disappears. We pass problem to nucleus now, so to nuclear theories.
Yes, so Victor's absolutely right with the atomic parity. If you can measure on a chain of isotopes, then the atomic physics largely cancels out. And in fact, the interesting sensitivity is to what you mentioned, you can get access to the neutron skin by looking at the variation in...
Yeah, but what I want to finish this sentence, in this case, for ratio of isotopes, effect is parallel to, not orthogonal, but parallel to what you're measuring in electron scattering. So it's an alternative way and the possibility to compare the results. So if you agree with standard model, it's fine. But as soon as you produce new physics, there will be question, is it new physics or something else? In this case, comparison of measuring of parity violation on different isotopes is a big help.
Yes.
And I think that people really want to do this, and parity violation ratio on different isotopes.
Excellent, thanks.
I remember when these parity experiments were done to get nuclear structures, strange quark contribution, there was ambiguity whether radiative corrections, but it was hard to interpret whether it's strange quark contribution or effects are due to radiative corrections. So they are gone at lower Q square. So if you observe something away from the standard model,
I think what you're referring to is when you're looking at the strange magnetic form factor, which you measure at large angles, and then there are effects due to the axial form factor. Right? The ordinary axial form factor has hard to control radiative corrections in electron scattering. So in fact, that's one of the motivations for us going to very forward angle. So there's only a tiny contribution from axial pieces there. There's also new data from Mainz, from the PVA4, where in combination with the older G0 data on the backward angle scattering, they get very good consistency on the contribution from axial radiative corrections. But you're right that to disentangle the strange magnetic form factor from axial radiative corrections, you had to go to a deuteron target and compare hydrogen to deuterium. But at forward angles, it doesn't affect us.
I just wanted to ask a question in regards to the evaluation, the gamma Z box. As you noted, the central values are rather comparable, but the errors are different. So whose error did you adopt for your
actually,
final analysis? Or is it not
in the, yet in the very first analysis, we could use almost any error bar, and it was subleading order. Okay, so
we're anticipating
what
the
we're anticipating
of the
doing. We're in a little bit of a debate. We would love to use the Adelaide JLab Manitoba error bar because it's smaller. But in fact, if we adopt the larger error bar here, we've actually had what we called a gamma Z boxing workshop where we got the groups all together at Jefferson Lab to fight it out. Over the bottom, sorry. Anyways, there's not yet consistency on understanding what these are, but if we use this, the scale of this is about a 1% uncertainty, and our final result will be somewhere around a 5% or 6%. So if I use this 1.5% uncertainty and absorb, it will be added in quadrature. It won't make a difference to the experimental result, fortunately. But we'd love to be able to adopt that one if we could.
Questions? Then let us thank all the speakers in this afternoon.